Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. This week, the big issue is the future of the president of the United States, Joe Biden. A lot of developments, clearly big-time Democrats, big-time donors, big-time celebrities pushing him to drop out of the race. He's defiant in saying, no, I'm not going. And he doesn't have to go if he doesn't want to go. So there's this extraordinary, never seen before fight happening right before the Republican convention and weeks before the Democratic convention. We have several different perspectives on that this week on the show. Alex Thompson from Axios has been doing some of the best, most quoted reporting on the Biden White House for some time, but really has stood out during this period based off of his years of reporting on the Bidens and their family. And so we're talking to him for an update of what's happening. Then we get the pro-Biden side from Tom Perez, who's a senior advisor to President Biden, the former chair of the DNC, former labor secretary. And then we get the pro-Trump side from Dave Rubin, a former liberal. He would call himself a classic liberal who's disappointed with the party and who is now supporting Trump after supporting Ron DeSantis. So lots of perspectives, but let's start with Alex and the latest on where the party is at.
Axios's Alex Thompson joins us now from Washington with more. Alex, welcome back to The Issue Is.
So good to be here.
You got access to a tape of a top-level Biden campaign meeting. What are they saying behind the scenes?
Absolutely. So this was the third all-hands call that the top campaign leaders have organized just since last Wednesday. And that's a sign of how low morale is inside the campaign. There are campaign aides that feel disillusioned, that they feel that senior leadership was not honest with them about some of the president's limitations. You have to understand that even people that worked for Joe Biden were shocked by his debate performance, in part because they didn't see him all that often. So what's happened in this call is the campaign chair, Jen O'Malley Dillon, who ran his last campaign, was also his White House deputy chief of staff, basically tried to just be honest with the campaign staff and say, listen, I know things are bad. And she said, it has been very, very, very bad 2 weeks. She was trying to really level. She did it in a salty fashion. There were F-bombs being thrown around left and right. But someone gave me a tape of the call, in part because people still do feel a little disillusioned with how things are going. And they sort of, at this point, the rah-rah locker room speeches feel a little bit too little too late. But my understanding is that campaign is going to keep trying to do this to try to turn around morale inside the building, both in Washington and in Wilmington, Delaware.
Yeah, we've seen a whole lot more leaks than we did before this debate. Meanwhile, the top Democrat in the House, Hakeem Jeffries, who wants to be the Speaker of the House, visited the White House this week and then put out this letter. And the letter says basically that he told the president what the Democratic caucus has been telling him. Here's something the letter doesn't say, Alex. It doesn't say, we endorse Biden. We're behind him 100%. How do you read that and what's happening behind the scenes on Capitol Hill?
This is one of those classic political letters that it actually is about what he doesn't write rather than what's on the page that is newsworthy. And you're right. There's not a universal, we think you're the nominee, we're behind you 100%. And that's because Hakeem Jeffries' caucus does not feel that way. Beyond the people that have gone public, I think we have about 20 or so, probably getting around two dozen of House Democrats that have called on Joe Biden to step aside. There are a lot more that are privately considering doing the same thing, that have been drafting up statements. And part of the issue here, and part of the reason why Hakeem Jeffries went to the White House to talk to President Biden, is I can tell you that members of Congress are having a hard time getting in touch with the president and his top team. And not just like backbenchers and people that are sort of gadflies, like serious people that have serious concerns and want to be on board with Joe Biden. But the fact that they are not being able to get through is only raising more questions. And that's what Hakeem Jeffries' letter and what his meeting was about expressing, making sure the president understood the severity of the crisis of confidence in parts of the Democratic caucus.
Yeah, and Notice is reporting that there was a call with the Hispanic caucus and that Mike Levin, the California Democrat, on the call said, "Mr. President, you should step aside." And then the call was quickly stopped after that. At the time of this taping, two California Democrats in the House have asked the president to step aside. There's Levin, and then there's also Scott Peters, both of them from Southern California. But we know there are plenty of other Californians privately, to folks like you and me, that have expressed their concerns about him but haven't been ready to go public yet. Let's talk more about your reporting, because years before other reporters dared to even bring it up, you have been talking about this issue of the president's age and the steps that some of his aides have taken to sort of hide his age and cognitive challenge issues. Can you expand on what some of those have been?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first stories I really began digging on was after Joe Biden said that he was going to run for re-election, because then it wasn't just about what they were doing in the moment. It also, every single thing they did was going to have to be amplified 4.5 years from now. And I always sort of looked at it from a mental fitness standpoint beyond November 2024. And so some of the first stories were about stuff that was out in the open, but you just had to scrutinize. So one example was the schedule. He very rarely was on camera in public outside the hours of 10 to 4. Aides told me privately, and some aides even said publicly, that he almost never did events before 10 a.m. After 4 p.m., it's much more common that he would do a closed-door fundraiser or something that's not on camera. And when he was on camera, you noticed that he would often make more gaffes. Aides told me that he would get tired. He was much more easily fatigued. And that would influence his ability to communicate, influence his ability to, you know, just do parts of his job. And that was the first story. And then you obviously saw, as his, you know, physical health was really declining, the little stage management things they did in order to try to obscure it. Now, some of them seemed, you know, little and harmless, right? You had, you know, him wearing more tennis shoes, using the shorter stairs. You know, in his physical, they used a bunch of medical jargon to basically say he's doing a lot of physical therapy because his gait had stiffened to such a degree. When they were walking to Marine One, instead of him walking by himself, they would send sort of a phalanx of aides that would walk between him and the cameras, making it a little bit, his gait and his walk a little bit more obscure. So, you know, there were steps the entire White House was taking to sort of put a bit of a cone around him to sort of obscure what was becoming a worse and worse health issue.
And you've also spent years researching a potential book about the Biden family. Can you talk about what Hunter Biden is doing right now in relation to this crisis for his father?
You know, the Biden family has always been super involved in every political campaign Joe Biden is in, and they especially get more involved in moments of crisis. You know, there is this sort of Biden mythology with some truth, is that basically the Bidens are at their best when their backs are against the wall and they unite. And so that's why you've seen Hunter become more involved. He attended a speech writing meeting after the debate. You know, right after the debate, it was Joe Biden met with his family at Camp David. They also did a photo shoot there, but they were very involved in the meetings. The family is more involved and powerful now than they have been almost ever, because when at moments of crisis, they sort of circle the wagons around themselves.
You know, this week we heard from George Clooney, who hosted Biden at an L.A. fundraiser a few weeks ago. Clooney writing in the New York Times that Biden can't win and that all the elected officials he knows have said that to him privately. Reportedly, Clooney gave Barack Obama advance warning about that op-ed. What is Barack Obama's role behind the scenes?
Absolutely. You know, Barack Obama has expressed concerns, as if any Democrat would. But it's been very notable how careful he has been, especially with the only public remarks he has made is one of support right after the debate. And while there's been reporting trickling out, he is being very careful. And the reason is because Joe Biden still deeply resents the fact that in Joe Biden's mind, at least, Barack Obama chose Hillary Clinton over him before 2016. Now, Obama's team has a very different version of events, but Joe Biden believes that, feels that, wrote about some of it in his book. And as a result, there's this feeling that if Obama were ever to be too aggressive in trying to push Joe Biden out of the race, it actually could backfire and ensure that he does stay in the race. As a former Biden aide told me, Obama already used that chip once. You can't push Joe Biden out of a race against Donald Trump more than that.
Speaking of Donald Trump, how does he see all of this? How does this potentially impact what the Republicans do at the RNC next week, where you and I will both be reporting?
You know, Donald Trump has, for once in his life, gone quiet. And it's been really notable to see him basically lay low and let the Democrats sort of engage in this. You know, it's sort of a circular firing squad, but it's also trying to come to grips with the fact that they're putting up a nominee who may not be able to do the job for four more years. And that's sort of this morally gray calculus a lot of Democrats are going through. You know, all of them would still prefer Joe Biden to Donald Trump, but I think there is some fear of doing so, knowing that he may not be able to serve four more years. So Donald Trump is basically just laid back, let it all hang out. Now, there was some initial fear among Republicans about, well, what is he going to do about his vice presidential pick? Because now Donald Trump doesn't know exactly who he's running against. My understanding is the Trump campaign really just did not let that affect their thinking, that they're going to try to stay to their strategy. And even if it does not end up being Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, that they feel that the ticket that they're putting together would beat any sort of Biden-aligned Democrat anyway.
And lastly, based off of everybody you talk to, do you have a gut feeling about how this thing ends? Does Joe Biden end up being the Democratic nominee in November?
I hate predicting. I mean, my gut is that Joe Biden is a very resilient person and a very stubborn person. And Joe Biden believes with almost a religious fervor that he is the most electable person against Donald Trump. And if you believe that, why would you get out? And so I do sort of think that barring something else coming down the line, Joe Biden is going to ride this out and stick it out. And the thing that's worrying a lot of people that have worked for Joe Biden, that dedicate a lot of their primes, their lives to his very lengthy career, is they feel that if he stays in this and loses, that this could be end up being the first line of his obituary and sort of undermine, you know, a lot of that legacy. But you know, Joe Biden has surprised doubters before, and that sort of self-belief is what he's counting on.
Bill Maher has called him Ruth Bader Biden, sort of referencing the fact that she stayed potentially too long and then ended up having a justice replace her, who ended up leaving to Roe v. Wade being overturned. Alex, thank you. We can check out your reporting at Axios.com. And a quick note about you. You know I'm biased about you as a fellow Agora High School grad, but I want to take a moment to give you your due. You talked about these issues when almost nobody else would. Everybody was scared to. And now you've been everywhere with scoop after scoop. So thank you for all the important and fearless reporting. It's really, really great.
That's high praise, especially from someone I really respect, too. So thank you very much, Alex.
Great to have you on The Issue Is.
Our thanks to Alex Thompson. Now to our conversation with Tom Perez. He currently is a senior advisor to the president, works on the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. Before that, he was DNC chair. Before that, he was the labor secretary under Barack Obama, with Joe Biden being the vice president. Tom Perez and the White House reached out to us to join us this week in our studio. Here's our conversation.
Here is Tom Perez earlier this year at an event with L.A. Mayor Karen Bass. He's here in his role as senior advisor and assistant to the president and part of the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs team. Perez served as the chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 2017 to 2021. Before that, he served as labor secretary in the Obama-Biden administration from 2013 to 2017. What a resume. Tom Perez, welcome to The Issue Is for the first time.
It's good to
have
be with you,
in
Alex.
Studio. Thank you so much. What a week for President Biden. You know, there are a lot of folks, including Democrats, that are calling for him to step aside. Some are challenging his mental acuity after seeing what they saw on the debate stage. As somebody who works with him and talks to him all the time, was that debate performance an aberration?
Of course it was. I've had the privilege of working with him dating back to the 1990s when I had hair. And, you know, he's never been the world's greatest debater. But we're not electing the debater-in-chief, we're electing the commander-in-chief. And as someone who had the privilege earlier this week of being at the NATO ceremony, the respect that the president commands and has earned, NATO's stronger than ever now because of President Biden's leadership. Our economy is stronger than ever because of President Biden's leadership. People are, I understand the concerns because it was he had, by his own admission, a lousy debate. And what I see day in and day out is someone who's tireless. It's a 24/7 job. As you know, in the run-up to that debate, he'd been back and forth to Europe, not once, but twice. I know what that takes out of me when you go six, seven time zones.
But that, I mean, that's part of the job, though, right?
Of course it is.
To be willing to do that at any time. And we know, unfortunately, the aging process only goes one way. And he's asking to be in the job for 4 more years. And if we saw that at this point, and we think about 4 years from now, are you comfortable with him being the president at 86 years old?
Absolutely. I mean, look, he had a bad debate. And again, by his own admission, no excuse. But we look at what we've accomplished, and there can be no debate about the fact that this administration has done so much for so many different people, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's $35 insulin, whether it's investments in housing, unprecedented. Look at our unemployment rate. The European leaders who are here, we're the envy of the global economy, and we're helping people day in and day out. And that's what it's all about. And frankly, there can be no debate about the fact that women's reproductive health is on the ballot. There can be no debate about the fact that Project 2025 is the Republican platform. And that is an absolutely extreme platform that would effectively eliminate the Department of Education, undo so many basic rights, and so there's so much at stake. Democracy is at stake, Dobbs is at stake, and frankly, common decency.
But that's the reason that a lot of people are concerned, arguing that President Biden is having problems articulating that message, that maybe Vice President Harris or somebody else could make the case that you're saying against Donald Trump better.
Well, I mean, he had a bad debate night, but you look at the polling. The polling's still dead heat polling.
Is it? How's it dead heat?
Happy to show you the polling. You look at the polls of polls, and this is a dead heat race. And you look at the battleground states. I know a little bit about polling.
Right, as former chair of the DNC.
One thing I'll say about today's polling. Presidential approval used to be a real proxy for how someone would do in a general election. So, for instance, in 2010, Barack Obama's approval was in the tank because he fought for the Affordable Care Act, and we had a bad midterm election cycle. In 2018, similarly, Donald Trump was in the tank, and because he tried to eliminate the ACA, he tried to dismantle abortion rights, which he succeeded in doing. And as a result, Democrats did really well. Now, presidential approval is not a proxy of how you do. If it were, we would have, frankly, kind of gotten our clocks cleaned in 2022. Mm-hmm. And instead, the opposite happened. And the reason is because people understand that if I care about women's reproductive health, Joe Biden's fighting to protect it, and Donald Trump, by his own admission, brought forth the demise of Roe versus Wade. You look at he still denies that the 2020 election was fair, and that's what inspired Joe Biden to run, which was democracy, and democracy continues to be a flashpoint, which it shouldn't be.
Right. And, another big issue is immigration. I know you've been involved with the Biden administration's efforts on that front, including an executive order. Can you explain what that means specifically for the people of California?
Sure. Most recently, I mean, the president did two things over the last 2 months. And prior to that, the president acknowledges our immigration system is broken. That's why day one he introduced, Alex, comprehensive immigration reform. And he said, and he continues to say, I will work with anyone and everyone who wants to work with me to get it done. He tried to do it earlier this year, introduced a bipartisan bill. One of the most conservative members of the Senate was working together with us. And do you know why that bill failed? Because Donald Trump said we can't give Joe Biden a victory. So seeing that the Republicans want to weaponize the issue and not solve the problem, the president did two things earlier within the last 8 weeks or so. Number one, an executive order on border security. Mm-hmm. And as a result, people coming to the border, the numbers of people coming to the border are down 40% since that executive order. The number of people coming now are it's lower than this point in 2019. We've made real progress in securing the border. And then secondly, and this is very important for folks here in California, further executive action to allow so-called mixed status families where one of the family members is undocumented, the other is a U.S. citizen. So you came to this country 20 years ago, you fell in love with a U.S. citizen, you got married, you have kids, you're a pillar in the community, but you're living in the shadows. And what the president said is, we are going to use a legal authority we have called parole in place. So if you've been here 10 years or more and you're married, you can get out of the shadows. And by the way, about 130,000 families in California, we believe, qualify for that. And it's time to bring them out of the shadows and into the sunshine. And it's time to stop politicizing immigration. I worked on immigration for Senator Kennedy and with Senator Biden in the 90s. And by the way, you know who was a big champion of immigration in 1986? A guy named Ronald Reagan.
The last time it actually passed.
In 96 it passed. Yeah. Reagan was 86. Yeah. But the party of Lincoln and the party of Reagan was the party of immigration. And now the extreme MAGA conservatives are weaponizing this issue. The immigrants don't poison our blood, they enrich our communities. And again, these are the differences. This is why Joe Biden is running for president, to make sure we unite the country. Common decency is at stake here.
Even George W. Bush was much more pro-immigration reform than what we're seeing
right
now.
And to put a finer point on this, Alex, in 1996, when we needed help from a Republican governor to stem a very, very far-right amendment in the immigration reform, you know who stepped up? Then Governor George W. Bush of Texas. That was compassionate conservatism. Now, you know, my family taught me, you know, if you blow out your neighbor's candle, it doesn't make your candle shine any brighter. That's what Joe Biden has lived by. You know, we help our neighbor. We don't demonize our neighbor.
I know you've served as DNC chair. We're going to have a Democratic convention where some delegates are wondering whether they should even support Joe Biden. We've heard from George Clooney and members of Congress and senators, others that are saying that he should drop out. What is your bottom line message to Democrats who think that Joe Biden shouldn't be the nominee?
My bottom line message is what the president has said. I had a bad debate. Just as Ronald Reagan had a bad debate, the first debate in 1984 with Walter Mondale, and questions were raised about his age. But there can be no debate about the fact that we have come a long way. We've made unprecedented progress in these 3.5 years, and I have a vision for the future of making sure we protect a woman's right to choose, making sure that we do tax reform so that wealthier people pay their fair share and we don't balance the budget on the backs of working people. I have a vision that I have demonstrated a track record of accomplishment in. And so I always judge people by the totality of what they have done. I never judge people by what they didn't do one particular day. And that's what Joe Biden is about. It's about getting results. It's about democracy. It's about Dobbs. It's about common decency.
Lastly, we do something fun on this show to get to know you a little bit better. This is called Personal Issues. This is a rapid fire, first thing that comes to mind to get to know your cultural favorites, so we get to know Tom Perez. All right, you ready? What is your favorite TV show?
My favorite TV show right now is The Bear.
Favorite movie?
My favorite movie was Common Ground.
Favorite sports team?
Buffalo Bills.
Who's the best comic book hero?
Wow, geez. Dennis the Menace.
What's your favorite book?
Common Ground.
And who is your role model?
Roberto Clemente.
Why is that?
My email address has the number 21 in it. And he died helping people in need. Those of you who know baseball, he was a Rule 5 pickup by Pittsburgh. So people didn't give him a chance. And he rose up from humble beginnings to do great things, not only on a baseball field, but more importantly, in a humanitarian way.
Our thanks to Tom Perez. Now to our conversation with Dave Rubin, the conservative commentator who started out as a liberal, who's got a lot to say about a lot of topics. His show is called The Rubin Report, but this week he joins us on The Issue Is in studio for the first time. Here's our full conversation.
With us now is Dave Rubin, who started his career backing mostly liberals and is now backing mostly conservatives, or at least Republicans. Dave Rubin's show, which we encourage people to check out, is called The Rubin Report, which you can watch on YouTube and also on Rumble. I think we've got some video of that. Dave Rubin, welcome to The Issue Is for the very first time in studio. Great to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be with you. We did try to do this in studio during COVID, but I was not allowed in the building.
That is true.
I was an unsullied who was unvaxxed, and I had to go back home and Skype in to do it.
There was a vaccine mandate that was put in place that day, which they didn't tell me about in advance, and the people who were brilliant enough with that idea have all been fired. So I can say on camera, it was stupid then, and it's stupid now.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear.
I'm still here.
I should note that I did get your mom's cookies. Still, despite not being allowed in the building, I was given your mom's cookies. She makes an incredible chocolate chip with M&M cookie situation.
Well, now you're here, and it's all worth it. So let's talk about what a time, though, in politics. This historic moment. President Biden insisting that he's staying in the race. What do you think of that?
Look, the truth is something that we all know, whether we want to admit it, whether we're begrudgingly coming around to it, whether we've denied it this entire time. Joe Biden is not the Joe Biden of 4 years ago, of 10 years ago, of 20 years ago, or anything else. There is something cognitively going on there. We've all seen it. It's degraded. It's gotten worse. He's struggling to say one complete sentence. That debate, all the debate did was shine a light on it that now nobody can ignore. You know, people always talk about fake news, and one of the things that I say is, you know, people think that fake news is just the media lying about something or a headline not matching with the content of the story. To me, the most nefarious type of fake news is what the media will not report on. And it's been fairly obvious for years, even since before Joe Biden became president, that there was a cognitive problem there. To watch him on debate night was only to see without any question what most of us have known and what many of us online have been talking about, and to see the split screen, to see the gaping mouth, the confusion, you know, the inability to complete a sentence. It is now burst forth, and the mainstream media does not know what to do with it. And that's really where we're at the moment. It's a very sad moment for America outside of politics, whether I support his policies or not.
And kind of remarkable that his team asked for that debate. They thought that he was ready for it and put him in that position to be doing that.
Yeah.
So now the question is, where does the party go from here? Biden says, I'm still running. It seems like a lot of folks in the party are saying Kamala Harris is next, if not Biden. Is Kamala Harris, in your view, a stronger nominee? Do you think she could actually get more votes than Joe Biden at this point, given everything that's happened with the debate?
It's a little hard to say because, look, nobody is excited. There were very few people that were excited about Joe Biden in the first place. The polls have bared that out for quite some time. People see what's going on at the border. They see interest rates, mortgage rates, things of that nature, right? So that's one problem that they had. Now the cognitive issue is so burst forth that it's very hard to find someone, and I'm guessing your bookers are going to have a hard time doing it going forward, to find someone that can full-throatedly and honestly support Joe Biden. Now, the question with Kamala really is, as you know, she was polling at 0-1% in her own party when she dropped out when she was running as a presidential candidate against Joe Biden. She called Joe Biden racist in one of the debates. She is not
She didn't call him racist. She sort of suggested that what he did was racist. Yeah.
Sure. So the point is that she does not have a huge amount of support either. And it's very clear that the party apparatus does not want her, but there isn't a mechanism really to get rid of her. So if they're able to either force Joe Biden out, which Jill Biden clearly is against, and Joe himself or whatever's left there doesn't seem to be for, but even if they're able to trigger whatever that movement would be, well, then you have to figure out a way to push her aside. Now, I will say this, for all of my frustrations with Democrats in general, and it's really unfortunate as someone that considers myself an old school liberal, I will give the devil his due here. The Democrats will do whatever they need to do. If they feel that she cannot win and Joe's out, they will find a way to get rid of the first black female potential president. They will do it, and they will put up my good friend Gavin Newsom, or they will put up Gretchen Whitmer, or it does not even matter. They will do whatever they have to do, which, by the way, is in contrast to what the Republicans did in 2015. Don't forget, Donald Trump was an insurgent. He was against the entire party. He was going after the Bush-type Republicans. But the Republicans ran their primary process as it would have been done, and he won, and they accepted the outcome.
Yeah, although this time Joe Biden was an incumbent president, which is a little different than in the past. Sometimes that hasn't always been a robust primary. But certainly, if there would have been debates, which Robert Kennedy wanted and other people wanted, maybe we would have seen that Joe Biden several months ago, and we would be having a very different conversation right now.
Sure.
So next week is the Republican National Convention. Donald Trump will have his chance to address the country from there. What do you want to hear from him?
What I'd like to hear from him is actually what we've been hearing from him, which is a pretty measured and controlled Donald Trump. You know, I thought really, although the headline, of course, from the debate was the disaster that was Biden for an hour and a half, Donald Trump was quite good. His answer on abortion was the most thoughtful, cogent answer I'd ever heard him give, and even acknowledged that what he was saying, because he was not for a national abortion ban, might hurt him with the base. It could hurt him electorally. I think he allowed Biden to kind of make the missteps, and I think that that's what we should see from Trump. Now, you don't have to be the braggadocious Trump. We've all seen it. We know it. We know it's within you. You know you can do that at the rallies. But if he goes up there, and assuming that he's going to announce a VP, hopefully before he gives his speech, which is at the end of the convention, if he goes up there and says, hey, the country's in a bad spot, we all know it, lists out the reasons honestly, reminds people of how good things were in the country pre-COVID, things obviously got worse after COVID. Look at the world, look at the peace that was existing in the Middle East and the peace deals there and that Putin wasn't in Ukraine and all of those things. I think he has a very compelling case to make. So I think if he can just control some of the little birds on his shoulder that might be saying, oh, make fun of somebody or give this nickname, I think that's what people want right now, because everything's so wildly out of control. We'd like something just a little more decent, let's say.
As an old school liberal, are you concerned at all about what the Supreme Court just did, sort of expanding executive power when it comes to immunity? Some of what happened with January 6th, his comments about I am your retribution. Are you concerned at all that he might be unchecked in a second term? And that's not great.
Well, look, as a classical liberal, I believe in limited government. I believe in the individual. I don't want too much government power. I think most of the Supreme Court decisions actually scaled back some of the power of government. They're hurting some of the agencies that are kind of unaccountable and everything else. The comment about retribution and that sort of thing, that's sort of what I'm referencing in the earlier statement, which is if he can just control some of the overboard stuff, that'll be fine. What I would prefer Donald Trump to say is something that he has said instead of retribution, which is that the ultimate revenge will be success. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people are afraid Donald Trump's going to come into office again and he's going to be angry at all of these people who say mean things about him, and he's going to go after Rachel Maddow and Whoopi Goldberg and everything else. I suspect not, and they'll be very happy he's back in office because they'll be able to continue talking about him and continue getting ratings. But what I would prefer him do is actually get the economy going, take care of the border, fix some of the problems that we have, and then people will look at him and go, maybe he wasn't that bad, maybe he wasn't Orange Hitler, and that success will be the ultimate revenge.
Last time we talked, you said you wanted Tulsi Gabbard to be VP. Yeah. It doesn't seem like she's on the short list.
I don't know. I have no insight on who's on the short list, but I still think that would be the best choice. Yeah. I think if you want to get disaffected Dems, look, I'm in California, a place that you know I very publicly fled after the Gavin Newsom recall election.
You're back.
I live in the free state of Florida. I came back for the cookies. They were really good.
Yeah.
But What Trump has to do right now is appeal to the people that have now seen the radicalism in the Democratic Party. If you've seen the progressive movement and you think it's authoritarian, you think it's out of control, if you don't like DEI, you don't like wokeism, you don't like all this gender confusion, if you're proud of this nation, then you really have very little to do with the current Democrat Party. Guess who also has little to do with the current Democrat Party? Tulsi Gabbard. She's no longer a Democrat.
Right. So if you
so if you want to ease people into what could be a very wide tent conservative movement. And I think that's what Donald Trump represents, because he clearly is not some standard Republican or standard conservative. Well, then you might want to take a look at someone who has left the left, so to speak. And I think that's the opportunity, as opposed to just grabbing somebody from the base, which is just red meat and doesn't necessarily bring in new people.
I know you've made very clear that you're no fan of Governor Gavin Newsom. Just recently, Governor Newsom announced that he's going to be hosting a podcast with Marshawn Lynch, the old football player, and also sort of an agent that he's worked with. That's one of his buddies, Doug Hendrickson. What do you make of that? Politicking.
Well, I did not know that Gavin Newsom had solved all of the problems of California, that he had time to do a podcast. He solved all of the homelessness here in Los Angeles, that I passed many of them on the way here, or in San Francisco. Did he solve all of the drug problems? Did he solve all of the problems with people, literally over a million people fleeing in the last 3 years? I guess he solved. I missed the news this morning. So maybe he solved all of those problems. But this is just consistent with Gavin Newsom. Everything with Gavin Newsom is about Gavin Newsom. He is waiting and praying that something happens to Joe Biden. It's obvious. It's why he was at the debate. It's why he's at the stump right now. He's pretending to be for Biden because you want to cozy up as you're actually stabbing the guy in the back. Everyone knows it. Everyone sees him. He is a lizard person.
He, of course, says that he's totally for Biden and has never, ever thought about ever
running
for president.
Like he seems like a pretty authentic person, and I would take his word for it. Yeah,
that's what he says. We are talking with Dave Rubin right now, the host of the Rubin Report. And you've had this really interesting journey, starting as a classic liberal, somebody who worked with the Young Turks, talked on the left, and then had moved more towards the right, big Ron DeSantis guy. And I know you were already headed that way, but it seems like COVID really took it up another notch. Can you talk a little bit about your journey?
Oh, sure. It really did. I mean, I was definitely heading in that direction, really, really leaning on limited government and that you should make some decisions about your own life. These were the ideas that I was talking about on my show all the time. And then when you and I got to know each other a couple of years ago because of COVID and because I started very vocally talking about the lockdowns and the ridiculousness of masks and that 15 days to slow the spread, by day 16, I knew it was something was wrong because I was watching TV and every commercial was talking about the new normal. And I thought, what do you mean? We were told 15 days and now we're talking about the new normal. And then to see that in places, you know, I lived here in Los Angeles, that, you know, you had outdoor eating for 3 days. And then the woman, Sheila Kuhl, I think was the woman's name here in Los Angeles, who was the city supervisor, who county supervisor, who literally voted to close outdoor restaurants, but then went to an outdoor restaurant at Santa Monica, knowing that you still had a few hours to eat outside. So she didn't even believe in it. That's where I signed the Gavin Newsom recall for the first time. And what was most interesting about that was most of the people that I met at those rallies, they were not Republicans. They weren't even political. They were disaffected people they were business owners. They were restaurant owners. They were people who had just been mugged by the reality of the draconian lockdowns of locking down the beach that Gavin Newsom did and the rest of it. And I can tell you this very clearly, having moved to Florida, where now there's this huge influx of people from California, and the original Floridians, the OG Floridians, are always worried, right? They're going, oh man, why are you all coming here? You're gonna vote the wrong way and ruin this too. Everyone I meet, but particularly the Californians, are very clear on saying they are now Republicans. And the numbers prove that out, too, because when DeSantis took over in Florida, there were 300,000 more Democrats than Republicans. As of this week, there are 1.2 million more registered Republicans than Democrats.
I mean, that was the ultimate swing state. You think about 2000, Florida, and now it is not even in the conversation. It is a solid red state.
The Democrats have conceded it already.
Moved on, and also sort of happened in Ohio as well. Let's also talk a little bit more about you. You're a dad.
Yeah.
Relatively new dad. Right?
I got two kids running at home. They're little humans. They run around
and do all kinds of crazy stuff. How has fatherhood changed you?
Oh, my. I'm better at talking about politics than about my personal life. But how does it change you? You know, look, I think that I've learned that there is way more out there beyond just me and my needs and all of those things. And we all kind of know that intellectually, but when you wake up every day and there are these two little humans there that you can hopefully, if you do it right, fill up with enough good ideas and good stuff and the right lessons that they will go out there and do amazing things in the world. And I know we don't have the most traditional family by any stretch of the imagination, but I think families come in all different shapes and sizes and stripes and colors. And I think if you give goodness and good values to a child and you give them a chance to climb up a tree and maybe have that branch break and, you know, scratch their knee and all of that stuff, that hopefully that some of the stuff that guys like you and I are always talking about all the political stuff, hopefully that can be solved by solving other issues that aren't political, meaning get a good group of citizens out there who have been taught the right things. And that's why another reason that when I moved to Florida, I became so involved with DeSantis was I saw him fighting to get wokeness out of schools. And I suddenly had two kids and I was thinking, would I ever want my kid to go to school and be taught that he's not the gender that he was born, or be taught that America was bad, or that he's bad just because he has white skin, or any of these things. So I think it made a lot of the things that I talk about sort of at the idea level, it made them much more personal. And I think that that's made me a better broadcaster. It certainly made me a better person.
And something else you guys do as a family that's interesting is you go off the grid, right? Every August?
Yeah,
this
is it. This is it.
Where you say, I'm not weighing in on anything. I mean, talk about how that works.
So literally.
This August is a pretty big political month.
I will not have this thing in my pocket for a month. You know, I did this will be my eighth off the grid August. I did it the first year as a joke. It was sort of like, let me just see if I can do this and not have a phone and not pay attention to the news and not read the newspaper and not watch anything or anything else. Literally no electronics, no computer, no iPad, no nothing. And it was wonderful. I found myself walking on the beach one day and I suddenly started thinking about friends from third grade that I remembered their names that I hadn't thought of in 30 years. Or I would remember entire albums, songs that every lyric of a song. And what I realized was we are just inundated with endless information, endless scrolling, which we turn into doom scrolling, only looking for negative things and all of that. And I thought, let me try this every year. And I think it's one of the things that has allowed me to stay sane in politics, because I don't have to tell you, politics and punditry, it can really make you crazy. I've watched a lot of good people kind of lose their mind.
Sure.
And I think taking that month off, it gives a little space to realize, boy, the world's kind of messed up, but it's going to go on without me one way or another. And I come back and I have fresh eyes on things. I feel like I can analyze things in a more proper way. And, you know, it's literally good for the body. It's good for the mind. It's good for the spirit. And all
so,
of that
like,
stuff.
So yeah. if for example, Joe Biden is replaced as the nominee.
I will not know. I will do everything I can not to know.
Wow.
I mean, you know, I literally have to avoid pizza places or gyms because they have TVs on and the rest of it. It's gotten more complex each year.
Right.
This year, I do have to say, I am more concerned this year than ever before. You know, one year I missed the Afghanistan withdrawal. That was obviously huge, but I found out about it when I got back. I think the year before John McCain passed away. There's always something, obviously. Mm-hmm. This year, it feels quite literally like, oh, Donald Trump might be in jail. Joe Biden might not be the nominee. Kamala might take over and have got kicked out.
Yeah.
We could be in World War III. It's a lot, but you know, at the end of the day, what can I do about it? So I'm still going to go to the beach.
Very blissful.
Yeah.
You're going to be the lucky one.
I'm still going to be having tequila on the beach.
We do something called personal issues on this show, which is we do 30 seconds to get to know your cultural favorites, things that you're interested in right now. Here we go. First thing that comes to mind, what is your favorite TV show right now?
The Office.
Favorite movie you've seen lately?
The Mad Max, the new one, Furiosa.
Okay. Favorite book you've read lately?
Oh, God, I don't read as much as I used to. The last thing that I read was probably, oh, my God, it's been a while, 12 More Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. It's really been
Who is your favorite basketball
long.
Player?
Clyde Drexler, without question.
What's your favorite way to relax?
Oh, I just put on Seinfeld and I fall asleep on the couch. That's it. That's it.
Well, Dave, thank you for coming in and sharing your views. I'm glad we got this done before August.
I'm very excited for the cookies. I can take the cookies. I don't have to eat all the cookies right now, right?
You can take the cookies. Enjoy. Yeah. Thanks for coming in. Best
Good
of luck to you out there.
Thanks to listen to The Issue Is in these extended conversations with Dave Rubin and with Tom Perez and with Alex Thompson. Next week, a special edition of the show on the road in Milwaukee. The Issue Is, broadcasting from a convention for the very first time, because 4 years ago we didn't get to do that because the conventions were virtual due to COVID. Thanks so much again for listening. Please like us, subscribe, let people know about us, and send me a note. Let me know what you think of the show. I'm Alex Michelson. Have a great one.